Okay, let me start from far away with introduction. So we have a beautiful theory of gravity, which is general relativity. And it has been very successful and super successful at the classical level in describing phenomena really over many orders of magnitude, like 30 orders of magnitude in scales. But it fails. It actually predicts its own failure also, we know. It produces singularities inside black holes, and also in the beginning of the universe, there is a cosmological singularity, and that's where this classical theory cannot hold. Well, it's also successful on the quantum level in being a consistent, effective theory of gravity interacting with matter at energies below Planck mass. But again, if we just stick to that theory and start to compute, say, scattering amplitudes in the theory, we discover that they become very become large, and like the naive probabilities exceed unities at the energies above Planck mass, which means that the theory should break down and there should be some EV completion. So this is the big question. I mean, what this UV completion is, and I think it's fair to say that at the moment we don't really know what it is. So it's worth exploring various possibilities, and I think any of these UV completions should really will necessarily have to reject some of, or modify, maybe deform some of these principles of classical theory. String theory, for example, and loop quantum gravity, as far as I understand, they go from the formalism of local quantum field theory to something else, to some non-local degrees of freedom, like strings or loops. And what I will be talking about is another approach which tries to preserve the locality of the field theory, so basically try to stick to this formalism of quantum field theory that is very successful for description of other forces in nature, but maybe sacrifice some part of diff invariance. Well, ideally, as little part as possible, but we'll see that. Yeah, that's a quite serious sacrifice. The lead here is to try to pursue this approach and see where it takes us actually. So I don't know. At the end, as we'll see. From the talk, I won't be able to argue that this is the gravity that, I'm not in the position to argue that this is the approach that describes a quantum gravity in our real world, but at least on the way we'll discover some interesting theories with interesting gauge groups and which bear a lot in common with quantum gravity as we understand it. Okay, so namely, like the concrete question I'm going to pursue is, can we formulate a complete theory of gravity just using the formalism, usual formalism of quantum field theory? So what I mean by a good theory, by a complete theory, is that it should be unitary, as the quantum mechanics demands. It should have finite number of degrees of freedom. So yeah, in this sense, it's different from, say, string theory. And calculation should be under control. So there should be either some notion of weak expansion, like small parameter for weak coupling, or maybe other ways to control the theory.
So quantum field theory doesn't have a finite number of degrees of
freedom. Well, finite number of particles, if you wish. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Finite number of particles?
Yeah, of types of quanta.
Species,
yeah. Okay, so first let's review the argument why general relativity cannot be complete per se. Well, there are different ways to see it, but I think the most transparent is the following. So let's take the Einstein-Hilbert action, expand it around the flat space in the perturbations of the metric. Then we get a quadratic part and the interaction terms, and let's see how these interaction terms behave when we zoom to shorter scales. So to zoom to shorter scales, we scale coordinates. And then, given that the amplitude of the quantum fluctuations are set by the quadratic part, we should also rescale the metric in such a way that we preserve the value of the quadratic action. So the metric should scale the way it's written here. And the interaction terms then, because they contain higher powers of the metric, they scale with positive powers of this scaling parameter. Well, this power is positive for any number of dimensions bigger than one. Yeah, and the number of dimensions, I will always be counting a number of space dimensions. So for any space-time with more than one spatial dimension, interactions scale positively at small distances when we zoom into smaller distances, so meaning that interactions become stronger and eventually diverge. So we lose control of the theory. And well, in a different way that can be seen in the computation of quantum corrections to the three-level action, we start generating more and more operators with higher derivatives. So the theory loses predictive power. So, well, how this can be remedied? One attempt was done quite long ago by Stelly. And he, one may start from the observation that in gravity, the action interactions necessarily contain arbitrary higher powers of the metric. This is required by the structure of the diffeomorphism, the group of diffeomorphisms. So this is different. This is an essential difference from Young-Mills theory, in the, and it's more similar probably to sigma models in particle physics. So if we want to bound the interactions at short scales, we should invent a way to make the scaling dimension of the matrix fluctuations to go to zero, so that these interactions do not grow. And a simple way to do it in four dimensions is actually the following. Is to say, okay, let me implement the Einstein-Hilbert action by the terms quadratic and curvature. So then if I take these terms, expand them around flat background, I get that I receive contributions with higher powers of derivatives, higher derivatives here. And these contributions dominate in the ultraviolet. So at high energies, because of more derivatives, they produce more like powers of momenta, so they dominate there. And now, if I want to keep this part of the action invariant under rescaling, then I actually notice that I don't need to rescale the metric. So indeed, the scaling dimension of the metric in that case is zero. And again, on the technical level, this manifests itself in the change of the asymptotic behavior of the graviton propagator, which now goes down not as 1 over k squared as usual, but 1 over k to the 4. And that makes the integrals in the loop better convergent. So very good. The theory, well, that's already suggested that the theory should be renormalizable. And indeed, it has been proven to be renormalizable and moreover, asymptotically free. So it seems like that's very good. I mean, why are we still questioning what quantum gravity is? Well, the problem with the theory is the following, that the very same higher derivatives that improve the asymptotic behavior of the propagator, they also make the theory non-unitary, because now we get higher derivatives in time, and that is known to lead to additional degrees of freedom that have wrong statistics. Well, or another way to see it is to say that this 1 over k squared k to the 4 propagator, if I try to write a Chell-Endemann representation for it, then it necessarily will arise as a difference of two propagators behaving as 1 over k squared. And the difference means that, I mean, this minus sign here means that we cannot give a physical interpretation of this massive pole. So the theory is not unitary, and we don't know how to make sense of it at the quantum level. So that's something which does not work. So a way out was suggested by Hojava 10 years ago. So he said, okay, so we want to reconcile two contradicting properties. On one hand, we want to increase the number of derivatives to improve the behavior of the propagators. On the other hand, we don't want to introduce more time derivatives. We want to stick to two derivative action in time. Well, that seems to be a contradiction, but one can do that, in fact, if we assume an additional, make an additional assumption, or like additional, introduce additional structure. But by saying that space-time is not space-time is endowed with a preferred time foliation, so there is a preferred global time somehow, on the fundamental level, and then there is no problem. We can write down an action that has just two time derivatives and more derivatives in space. So on the geometric side, that reduces the full group of diffeomorphisms down to only those diffeomorphisms that preserve this foliation structure. So we can do arbitrary shifts or changes of coordinates in the foliation leaves. And maybe we can also reshuffle these foliation leaves, their labeling, but no more than that. Well, and now with this type of action, you can really observe that yes, you can now make the scaling dimension of the metric zero. If when you do this zooming on smaller distances, you scale differently space and time. So in fact, if we are in space-time with d special dimensions, the time coordinates should be scaled as space coordinates to the power d. And then indeed, you know, like the scaling dimension of the metric becomes zero. So far, so good. Okay, so let's take this idea and see if we can make sense of it. Yes, it turns out that we can. We can build such series. Well, as I already said, we want to preserve as many symmetries as possible. And in this case, these are for relation preserving diffeos that are the formulas for them are put there. Well, given that we have these diffeomorphisms in space, which can be time dependent, we need the gauge fields for these transformations. So, in space, gauge fields for the transformations are the spatial metric that changes under spatial diffeos, and because the spatial diffeos depend on time, we need also a vector field Ni called Ni here. That ensures covariant under this transformation. And for reshuffling or labeling of the leaves of the foliation, we can also introduce another gauge field N. I will discuss in a minute whether this is dynamical or not. The Lagrangian that we get from this consideration is written here. So this is a general form of the Lagrangian invariant under this group of reduced or foliation preserving diffeos. So it contains something which can be called the kinetic term, so a part which contains time derivatives of the metric. Well, you don't need to really look at these formulas in the sense. I mean, this is just to illustrate. It's an extrinsic curvature of the foliation leaves. But the important thing that it contains the time derivative here. We can construct two different terms out of this extrinsic curvature and some potential that in principle can depend on the metric and this additional function. And it should contain up to 2D spatial derivatives. Yeah, so that's precisely to implement this idea of anisotropic scaling, where you know the time and space scale with appropriate dimensionality. Well, under this anisotropic scaling, the dimensionality of the fields gamma and n are just zero, so as we wanted for the metric, and for the lapse it comes out automatically. Yeah, this n is called lapse, and for this vector field n, which is ni, which is called shift, the dimensionality is d minus one, so it's positive dimensionality. At low energies, if we just take this Lagrangian and look what happens at it at low energies, it actually turns out to be not that far away from general relativity. So at low energies, it reduces to a theory to Einstein-Hilbert theory plus a sector with a single scalar degree of freedom, interacting with the metric. I mean, some quite special. Additional scalar field has a quite special dynamics. But apart from that, I mean, it's just a scalar field. So it's a scalar tensor theory. Well, I will come back to its phenomenology at the end of the talk. So in this sense, the theory I'm considering is relative to GR. I mean, it's a cousin of GR. Now, we started from the argument that this theory is expected to be renormalizable because we have this nice property of that interactions do not really grow at short distances. But then the question, I mean, can we really prove that or what? And in fact, there is a very naive proof that, so here I give a very naive argument that shows that, yeah, it should be renormalizable. And the argument goes like that consider the partition function of the theory and expand it perturbatively in interactions. Then, here you generate like a bunch of the products of interaction Lagrangians that do produce some divergences in general. But because the dimensionality of this whole object here is less than zero because we enforced the correct scaling dimensionality, then well, these divergences can also be only of dimension zero. And if they are local, they should be an integral over space-time of some local Lagrangian density of the corresponding of the scaling dimension 2d. And then we don't know, we know all the operators, we already know all the operators with these properties. We already included them in the beginning in the tree-level action. So essentially, all the normalization could go into the couplings that are already present in this theory. Well, this argument is very naive because it assumes, well, it involves these two statements, that divergences are local in the first place, and second, we also, when we say that we know all the operators that have certain dimensionality, we also have in mind that we know all gauge invariant operators of certain dimensionality. And only in that case, only if these divergences are gauge invariant, only in that case we really renormalize the original theory. So we have to make sure that these two assumptions are satisfied. And they actually both hinges on kind of, I mean, they become non-trivial because the theory is not a simple theory, but is a gauge theory, has a gauge invariance. So here I will, yeah, in the following I will often use a toy model of two plus one dimensional Hojava gravity, which is actually very simple. And yeah, it serves to illustrate many concepts, and then the generalizations to higher dimensions are quite straightforward. So here, first of all, I'm saying it's two plus one dimensional projectable version. So what this projectability condition means? It means that this additional field N that we introduced to gauge the relabeling of time, in fact, need not be a local field. It can be just a global field depending on time in principle, because our reparametrizations are global. But then it's not a local degree of freedom. So we actually can gauge it away. I mean, for the analysis that I'm interested in, we can fix it to unity and gauge it away completely. So we remove it from the theory whatsoever. Right. So then we are left with just two fields, like one tensor and one vector. Yeah, this theory in two plus one dimensions, the most general Lagrangian of it is written here on the slide, and it's fully parameterized by just three couplings, G, lambda, and mu. And unlike general relativity in two plus one dimensions, it has propagating degrees of freedom. For normal gravity, it's known that in two plus one dimensions it's not dynamical, and then it's actually can be exactly solved. But this theory is non-trivial. It has a single scalar degree of freedom, you know, propagating on this space-time. It's degree of freedom. I mean, this degree of freedom and dynamics of this degree of freedom is known to be well behaved when these parameters satisfy certain inequalities. Good. So it's a self-consistent theory. Let's study its properties. And the first thing we want to study is how the theory is renormalized. What happens with it under renormalization? For that, we need to fix the gauge, and the general trick to fix the gauge is to supplement the original action, the original Lagrangian, with a gauge fixing term, which is quadratic in some linear combinations of the fields. And not to spoil the power counting. Not to spoil the scaling, it should have the same dimensionality at the tree-level Lagrangian. So in this case, 4. Dimensionality should be 4. And then we can, if we insist, I was saying, okay, so this is some, these are some linear combinations of the fields, and in between, in principle, one can insert a differential operator. Now, if we, like the first idea is to say that this operator in between should be local. But then if it's local, it has, it's either unity or it has a certain number of derivatives, so its dimensionality is positive. And if we want that the whole thing, that the whole Lagrangian has dimensionality just 4, then it means that dimensionality of these guys here should be 2 or less. And there are only two combinations that obey this this condition. Well, actually, one can also take their sum. I think it's not that important. In both cases, if we just take the make this gauge choice, we find that the propagator of the correlation function of the shift vector behaves as 1 over k squared, where k is a purely special momentum. So it does not have a frequency inside. And that's bad, because it means that in real space, yeah, actually, I think that's more illustrative to write it in the real space. In real space, the singularity of this propagator here is non-local. It's non-local in space. Yeah. So there is delta function in time here, so that gives a singularity. But then there is a logarithmic dependence over the whole you know, over the whole space. And taken at face value, if I just start considering loop integrals with this type of propagators, I will find that divergences are non-local. Well, in this case, in space, well, if you choose a different gauge, you can also find non-local divergences in time. And well, that raises a question. Are these the non-localities canceling or not? Well, it's very hard to track, especially at higher loops, if we use this gauge. So if we want to really understand the renormalizability properties of the theory, we better find a gauge where such non-local divergences are absent. So it should be some, yeah, if we go back to the textbook examples, this gauge corresponds to something like Coulomb gauge in electrodynamics or in Young-Mills, where, yeah, one gets correlation functions that say depend only on space and not on time. Well, no, depend only on spatial momentum, but not on frequency. And in the textbook example, we know how to choose a good gauge. So we have to go to relativistic gauges, something like the Donder gauge for gravity, or for Young-Mills, Erksai gauge for standard model. So the question is, what the analog of this relativistic gauge in this case? And let me skip probably this technical part. And then here is the answer that we found, that in fact one should consider linear combination. Well, again, this is quite analogous to what you find in relativistic examples. You have to consider the gauge function, which involves time derivatives of the shift, necessarily, and higher space derivatives I think Laplacian is missing here. Should be Laplacian here. No, it's okay. It's correct like that. So yeah, higher derivatives of the metric. But then this operator insertion between the prod between in this quadratic form of the gauge fixing Lagrangian should be a non-local operator. So it actually should be inverse Laplacian. So you see this O, it must be inverse Laplacian to preserve the correct dimensionality. But that's not a problem, in fact, because this appears only in the gauge fixing term. Well, in this gauge, there are some nice properties of this specific choice. So it disentangles the mixing between kinetic mixing between the metric and the shift vector in the quadratic action. So that's nice. We can split the two sectors. It actually gives regular propagators for all fields. Well, regular means that they all uniformly decays, that they all uniformly decay in space and time, as they should, or in momentum and energy, as they should according to the anisotropic scaling. And this is a family of gauges with two parameters. And it has straightforward generalizations to higher dimensions. So there's nothing special about two dimensions here. One just have to modify both the gauge fixing function and this operator insertion. having this good gauge, one can go very quickly. Having the gauge is not enough, of course. We have to just to go then and make a proof of renormalizability. Well, this is a bit like university exercise. The exercise we had at the university when we were studying, you know, renormalization of electrodynamics or Young-Mills, we just have to, this step just scalar renormalization of scalar theory. So we go and classify the type of divergence that can appear and make sure that they can be subtracted consistently order by order in the loop expansion. So that can be done. Let me go over that maybe. See how I'm doing with time. So here it's important. When we repeat this textbook exercise, one notices that it's very important that really all these propagators that appear, they have this homogeneous decay in momentum and energy. If it were not the case, the argument just breaks down and doesn't go through. As I said, one can introduce certain like degree of divergence for every diagram, which is actually scaling under a scaling of momenta and frequencies. If this degree of divergence is negative, then diagrams just converge, so they don't produce any divergences. And all the diagrams that have positive degrees of divergence, so can potentially diverge, they actually have dimension less than dimension 2D. So that is consistent with our expectation that we should produce only counter terms that already were present in the original three-level action. Two comments here are in order. So I have been discussing projectable case, projectable theory. Before that I say that, I actually already said that, but let me repeat that though I have been focusing on two dimensions, but all these arguments straightforwardly generalize to any dimension. So in principle, in this way, we get a normalizable series of quantum gravity in any dimension that we want. The second comment is that I have been discussing projectable case. In the non-projectable case, the situation is more complicated, and the proof does not go through, because there is an additional field coming from this additional function n, and this additional field has a propagator which has a regular part. That's fine, but also it has an irregular contribution. So of this instantaneous, if you wish, of this instantaneous form. So it's something which in after Fourier transformation produces a correlator over the whole space. And this term is present even in this family of gauges that we introduced. Moreover, it cannot be removed by any gauge choice, because actually one can show that it's physical. It persists in the interactions of physical external sources, for example, in the scattering amplitudes. The question about renormalizability of the non-projectable case remains open. Maybe these non-local contributions, maybe they can cancel in the loop expansion, but we really don't know. Good. So we have proved that all counter terms, they have the right dimensionality, but they will be the same as the terms in the original Lagrangian only if they are also gauge invariant. And this is not an easy task to prove, as we again know from our university years, I believe, where we were proving that for Young-Mills theorem. because what? Because the gauge invariance cannot be preserved explicitly in the calculation. It necessarily must be broken by the gauge fixing. Instead, what we have is BRST transformations, or maybe in a different way, you can say that they are Slavnov-Taylor identities. So I'll make sure that they are satisfied by the effective action, by the normalized effective action. very often when we have a symmetry, again, it's quite easy to argue that it's preserved at the quantum level. These are the cases when the symmetry is linearly realized. Then it's very easy to show that the corresponding word identities are not deformed. But this is not the case of BRST symmetry, which is not non-linearly reanalyzed. It's not a linear symmetry. And then it's deformed at the quantum level. It must be deformed. Or alternatively, either one should deform the symmetry, or if one wants to recover the original symmetry, one should redefine the fields that are present in the action. I'm reviewing what's happening in the usual quantum field series, in the standard quantum field series. yes, okay. And the peculiarity here of this particular theory, that unlike in the Young-Mills case, the dimensionality of the field itself is zero, is not positive. Yeah, in the case of Young-Mills, the dimension of the vector field is positive. So when you construct this field definition, it's actually always linear, yeah, because you cannot add higher powers of the field. Whereas in the case of this theory, the field can be can be put to any power. Any function of the field can be good enough. So that's a major complication. So we cannot just go as in textbooks and classify all possible field definitions. We have to do something more. And we have to do something more, which along the lines that were used by Barnish, Brandt, and Dano when they were proving the generalizability of higher order extensions of Young-Mills theory and general relativity. But I must say that this classical proof is really very and involves very complicated mathematics. So, to go and to prove a fact which I think to many particle physicists would be obvious, that we just start from Young-Mills and maybe extend it with additional higher order operators like f mu to the fourth, derivatives of f mu squared, and so on. That when we do that, like write an effective theory like that, and we want to compute loop corrections, they will have the same structure. Yeah, they will have a gauge invariant structure. That's something which is, I think, intuitively obvious, but the technical proof is very complicated. Moreover, it does not work for the case when the gauge group includes abelian subgroups. Somehow it breaks down. So when we realize that, yeah, and moreover, this specific proof, it applies to, really relies on the structure of four-dimensional diffeomorphisms in the case of gravity. So it does not directly apply to the case of Kurzawa gravity. And I think that was our big disappointment when we realized that. And we realized that we have to do everything from scratch. That's what we did. And the key tool here is to use background field formalism. When we say that our quantum fields, so we expand the fields in something which is called background. I mean, we call background like treating this part as an external field, plus quantum fluctuations. This hij and small ni here are quantum fluctuations over which we integrate in the path integral. And this trick, it doubles the number of gauge invariances now. So now we have one gauge invariance associated, original gauge invariance associated to BRST transformations of the fluctuations. And the second new gauge invariance, which transforms the background fields and the fluctuations linearly. So that's important that the second one acts linearly. And in this way, it provides a very important handle on the way to actually go through the whole construction of renormalization of this theory. In fact, usually this background field formalism is used at the level of one loop, because at one loop, usually we just say we integrate, we take say partition function and integrate over a quantum fluctuation, keeping some values of the background fields, and we get a background field effective action. And from this background field effective action, we can, for example, recover beta functions of the couplings. Yeah, and in that case, background effective action is automatically gauge invariant because, as I said, this background gauge invariance is linearly realized. So it's very easy to prove that it's preserved. But at higher loops, that's not enough to do this trick because at higher loops, we need to, the necessity to subtract subdivergences requires that we also keep, the full effective action. We cannot just integrate out the fluctuations. We also have to keep sources for them. Still, this background field approach is very useful, as I said, because it provides an important handle on how to disentangle the renormalization of the couplings from redefinition of the fields. And in fact, it was easier not to work directly with Kurzawa gravity, but just to consider a general situation of a theory. That obeys certain formal properties, but the physical content is that put in simple terms, just any theory which allows a sensible background field formulation. So for any theory which allows such a sensible formulation, we actually have shown that BRST structure is preserved by renormalization. And this includes all the known cases of young Mills with higher derivative extensions and so on, and general relativity and higher derivative extensions of general relativity, and also includes non-relativistic gauge theories, in particular Hojala gravity. And in a small bonus, it also includes theories with abelian subgroups. Okay. So that was boring general formalism. So now I'm coming to some more tangible results. Namely, okay, good. So we did some formal work, proved the renormalizability. But what about UV completeness? And what about asymptotic dynamics of this series? So take, again, this two-dimensional example. It looks quite simple. So let's sit down and calculate the beta functions for the running of these couplings at high energies. And there is one comment here that not all of these three couplings are independently physical one of those combinations is kind of gauge dependent. Well, actually, not the coupling itself is gauge dependent, but its beta function is gauge dependent. So we have only to consider those couplings which can be measured on shell, when our background field is on shell. And there are two combinations here, two combinations one can make of these couplings. One is a lambda coupling itself, just here. And the other is the gravitation coupling G appearing in the Lagrangian divided by the other parameter mu. So these are two essential couplings of the theory, and only their beta functions are really physical. And the physical meaning is that, okay, so this lambda, it characterizes the ratio between the two terms and the kinetic part of the action. And G, this curly G, is something which characterizes the strength of the interaction. So if G is small, then the interaction is weak. If G is large, then it's strong. Good, so we have to sit down and calculate. So we use, we work on the background gauge. We consider several gauge choices to make sure that our results are gauge invariant. And this calculation we did just using diagrammatic techniques. So we said, okay, there are fluctuations, hij, and I'm in the background gauge where I fix some value of gamma of the background metric gamma bar. And what I need to integrate out the fluctuation fields and find the effective action evaluated on this metric. But considering arbitrary metric is also complicated, arbitrary background is also complicated, so let's also take it close to be flat. Yeah, so we expand the background itself to be a flat part plus another field capital I, H. Well, and then the whole computation boils down to evaluation of these two simple looking diagrams where on the external legs we have this background metric, and inside in the loop there are fluctuations of the metric, the shift field N, and Fadeev-Popov-Goss. Of course, we should not forget about them. So these diagrams look simple looking, but every vertex here involves something like 100 terms. Okay, so this is okay. This just produces 100 terms, but here you get something like maybe 10,000 diagrams. I don't know. Anyway, this can be done. This computation can be done. And
how can this be done? Have you done it?
Yes. 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 and then looking at different normalization of the different terms in the effective action, we extract the normalizations of the couplings. And here are like formulas for the beta functions of the two essential couplings. Actually, they look very these are very simple expressions, I must say. Intermediate expressions are much more complicated, but this is a very nice result. But not boring you with I'm not going to bore you with this formulas. Let's better look at the plot, at the picture. Picture is always better. So here is the renormalization group flow in this theory. On the horizontal axis we have a variable coupling lambda. On the vertical we have g. Yeah, one remarkable fact about the beta function for g is that it's always negative. So here the flow goes from ultraviolet to the infrared. Yeah, so negative beta functions means that the flow is from weak coupling to strong coupling. So here there are obviously two points, which are two ultraviolet fixed points of the theory. And the flow starts from either here or here. This point is certainly asymptotically free. So there, for this point, we know for sure because the coupling G characterizing the strength is small, and the coupling lambda takes a value of order one, which means that the two terms in the kinetic action, they are of the same, of comparable order. Well, about the second U fixed point, it's hard to say whether it's asymptotically free or not, because though the coupling, the G coupling goes to zero, but for the lambda coupling, this is kind of boundary better let me say that here these vertical lines they delimit the boundary of the region where this theory makes sense. So it makes sense here and makes sense here, and we see that this asymptotic UV fixed point it lies on this boundary, which is not very good. So it's not. One loop computation is not enough actually to tell if this is if the theory is well behaved there or is strongly coupled. But so that's why I will be focusing only on this part of our G flow, where the UV fixed point is for sure asymptotically free.
Okay.
Yes, please.
You're not adding any sources, are you?
No matter, you mean?
Yeah, no matter.
Yeah, that's something we want to do. Yeah, to see whether it modifies the flow or not. But
now in three dimensions, which is more relevant to us,
yes,
for obvious reasons, what is the field content you would have? Does this behavior persist?
I will say a few words about that. Right. So another. Okay, so here we have asymptotic fixed point, and then we see that the flows, well, there are different RG flows. They all go to strong coupling. Well, there are in particular those flows that go to strong coupling along this line where lambda is equal to 1. And this is quite funny because at the formal level, just if you take the Lagrange and put lambda to be 1, we recover general relativity. So I'm not claiming that this theory flows towards general relativity. That's for sure not the case, but at least there is some there is some funny behavior going on here, and at the very least the theory provides an example of well-defined from the ultraviolet point of view, well-defined theory, gravitational theory that runs into strong coupling at low energies. I think it's like the first theory where one can really try to understand the notion of strong gravitational coupling. What does it mean in quantum strong quantum theory of gravity? Good. yes. Now that's the slide about three dimensions. This is work in progress. So what we have for the moment is a beta function for the only for one coupling out of six. In three dimensions, there are more couplings. There are a total six. So one coupling, namely lambda, and that's the expression there. The expression, on one hand, it's more complicated, well, as expected. But it's also, in many respects, it's similar to what we had before. So say, like behaviors, say different properties of, where this, properties like where this beta function has a pole or where it vanishes, they're quite similar to two plus one dimensional case, and also the let me see. Okay, so let me first say what this alpha here is. So it's more complicated. So there is this additional parameter alpha, which is actually just the ratio of the physically, the ratio of the two coefficients that appear in the dispersion relations of the scalar and tensor modes. So at high energies, both scalar and tensor modes, their energies or frequencies are proportional to k cube. And the frequency square are proportional to k to the 6. And, these dispersion relations, there are certain coefficients appearing in this dispersion relation. And the beta function for the coupling lambda depends on this ratio. And what one can do at this point is to draw the regions in the two-dimensional parameter space of lambda and alpha, where this beta function is positive and where it is negative. And we see that, yeah, actually, it's interesting to look here on this part. So this beta function is positive at large values of alpha and negative at small values of alpha. So it means that if we start from this region and go towards UV, then lambda will decrease and end up on here somewhere on the boundary. If we start here, we will end up on the boundary again. So there is a line in this two-dimensional plane, which potentially can contain a UV fixed point of this theory, though, of course, we don't know yet because we don't know the running of the other couplings, neither the running of alpha. Yeah, I probably should have said that already at this stage, if the theory were not asymptotically free, already at this stage we could have found that asymptotic freedom is absent. Yeah, if we would not have such a structure of the beta function as it's shown here. Yeah, imagine it would be positive everywhere here. So that's it. I mean, there would be no fixed points whatsoever. So now with these results are quite encouraging because they tell us that, yeah, maybe, at least, this possibility of having our ultraviolet asymptotic freedom is not excluded.
What does the scalar do? Do you have any idea how it couples to matter?
Good. That's I think is well. That will be on the next slide. Okay. but about the mass, it's massless. No mass. In perturbation theory. Okay, but I will come to that. Yeah, how it couples and. Now, I'm coming actually. I'm already in the position to start giving a summary of what I said. So first, a summary on the theory side. So we have discovered a class of models that represent a normalizable gravity series. So why I call them gravity series? Well, first of all, because they enjoy some part of diff invariance, as we already discussed. And because of that, they don't have any local gauge invariant observables. So that's something which is really peculiar to gravitational theories, and it would be interesting to study, somehow to address this issue. What are the proper observables in this series? And the second, in three plus one dimensions and higher, they contain transverse tensor degrees of freedom, which can be associated with gravitons. Well, moreover, as I discussed, at low energies they reduce to scalar tensor series, so not that far away from GR. In 2 plus 1 dimensions, the series are asymptotically free, so they are UV complete. And possibly they are so also in 3 plus 1. But that's more work is needed here to understand if it's true or not, because, yeah, that's quite tough computation. In the infrared correspondingly, they go into strong coupling. And that, I think, is actually a quite fascinating question on its own. So what does it mean? I mean, a gravity theory going into strong coupling, a theory without any local observables going into strong coupling. What is that? I mean, so what we can have there? I mean, I can throw some speculative words. Maybe there will be some kind of gravitational confinement or non-trivial fixed point. Who knows? It's not clear how to characterize this non-trivial fixed point, if any. Yeah, and about non-projectile case, we don't know still if it's normalizable or not. Now on the phenomenological side, yeah. So what's the phenomenological status? Well, here I think the I would say the status is not that brilliant as on the theory side. Namely, the projectable Hodge-Lipschitz gravity actually is not a good candidate for phenomenology because the scalar mode at low energies becomes unstable. The instability in principle is stabilized by higher derivative terms, but it's not clear where it goes actually. Maybe completely, well, it doesn't look like this theory can describe a homogeneous universe. Well, there can be another possibility that this extra field, or actually this foliation, develops large inhomogeneities. Okay, so the foliation cell becomes very crumpled. But Yeah, this but and then the matter somehow the action of matter averages over these crumples of this foliation and maybe decouples from scalar field from this foliation structure. But that's I would say very speculative. I mean that's I'm not claiming this is something which I can really show to happen. But probably it's worth studying. On the other hand, the phenomenology of the non-projectable case can be close to GR. So there are really like parameters that continuously, by changing them continuously, we can connect to GR. I mean, making them, well, in the sense that by making them, say, small, we can make the theory as close to GR as we want. But Lorentz invariance is fundamentally broken in this series. Yeah, there is no way out. One can just ask whether it can emerge as a low energy property of this theory. It's not that uncommon, in fact, in non-gravitational theories. So there have been studies starting from the works of Nielsen and Nomia, and then there are many works in high energy physics, but also in condensed matter, where you know from something which is fundamentally non-relativistic, an effective emergent Lorentz invariance at low energies would appear. Now the question is whether something similar can happen in gravity. Yeah, it's true that if it does, that must happen with very high accuracy. And here, like the real, I mean, very 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 tough observation comes from detection of gravitational waves in coincidence with electromagnetic waves from the merger of two neutron stars that happened 2 years ago. That restricts the velocity of gravitons. That restricts the difference between the velocity of gravitons and the velocity of photons to be less than 10 to minus 15. And that looks like it requires extreme fine tuning. So it's still possible to like formally satisfy this criterion in this theory. But I must admit it doesn't look appealing, this idea of fine tuning. Maybe what we got is just a pure theoretical exercise. Still, I believe, I have some outlook, what can be done here. So one idea which I think is most promising now is to look for some questions which can be addressed in this series as a toy model for real Lorentz invariant quantum gravity. Having or not having Lorentz invariance makes a big difference, but maybe there are also some questions that can be addressed in both series and some useful lessons can be learned. One of them is characterization of observables in this theory, because in both sides, there are no local gauge invariant observables. One should do something else. What are the proper observables? What is the basis of observables that reduce to local observables when we decouple gravity and things, questions like that can be addressed here explicitly in a well-defined framework where everything in principle can be calculable. Well, another question is the resolution of singularities. Again, in principle, they should be somehow well-defined in the theory if it pretends to be the complete theory of quantum gravity. And maybe information paradox can be also addressed, though at this point it's not clear if there are solutions that, or black hole, or solutions that can be served, can serve as black hole analogs, as analogs of black holes in this Hodgiava-Lipschitz setup. Well, I mean in this projectable Hodgiava-Lipschitz setup. In non-projectable, in fact, there are solutions that resemble black holes closely. the last idea that, like last hope for the theory to be relevant for real gravity in our world is that maybe somehow through strong coupling, which happens in the theory in the infrared, Lorentz invariance can emerge. So this additional degree of freedom maybe goes into confinement. I mean, that's here I'm starting speculating wildly. So goes into confinement, gets a mass, decouples, and we don't see it. Okay, that's a dream. Okay, thank you.
Structure, do you need like a global foliation structure, or is it enough? Is it if you have a local one?
Yeah, what do you mean by difference between global and local?
Okay, so like in from the point of view that at each vicinity of a point of a space-time point, you have a foliation.
Yes.
Or if you need a foliation that applies to your whole metric.
Ah, so for what I was talking about, local is enough. Yeah. So in principle, global is not necessary. Well, to have a in fact, everything I was discussing is a local field theory, a local normalization, you know, in some vicinity of the space-time. I don't know if with global foliation. Right. Yeah. Yes. There are actually solutions where you can construct the local foliation, but not the global ones. And they seem to be OK in this series. Yeah, so local is enough, yes. Yes?
And in the diagrams you presented, like, for example, in the 2 plus 1 beta functions, where is Newton's constant?
It's G? G, yeah. Well, the original Newton's constant is capital G. But then it is not gauge invariant by itself. Not the constant, but its normalization is not gauge invariant by itself. So the combination, which is whose beta function is gauge invariant, is this curly g over square root of mu. So that's an analog of Newton's constant at high energies, if you wish.
What I didn't understand is that. Well, we know the value of Newton's constant in our region.
Yes.
At least in 3 plus 1. So where, what would that mean for those couplings that blow up in the IR?
Yeah, it becomes large, yeah. So the Newton constant at, in the IR becomes large in this theory. Literally like that, yeah.
And yeah, but would any of those trajectories match the value that we measure?
Well, you have to cut them somewhere, right? Because we always observe at a certain finite scale, yeah? So if I come back here. So the coordinate along these trajectories is the energy scale where you are observing, yeah? So saying if we observe at this scale, that's the value of the Newton constant that we have. If we end up here. If we go to even larger distances, OK, we'll continue along this this trajectory.
Can I extend on that question? Because we've tested gravity in all sorts of scales.
Mm-hmm.
We set it down to a millimeter. In fact, we know gravity works as gravity down to up to hundreds of megaparsec scales. So this, if something starts becoming wrong, can't you see the change in those scales?
Well, this is two-dimensional case where I cannot cut these flows. They continue until deep infrared.
One.
Yeah, in 3 plus 1, I will just cut this flow but by relevant operators here. Actually, the curvature, the Einstein-Hilbert term would be a relevant operator. So it would cut this flow somewhere at some value. Because this is really ultraviolet asymptotic of the flow.
Yeah, of course.
So then it will be cut. So you have to cut at this, and then you get, and then you end up with the physical value of the gravitational constant. And all the deviations are encoded in this additional scalar field.
I see. Which, I mean,
yes.
Oh, yes. First question. The version of your theory that has black hole-like solutions, for example, could you tell a difference? How does a binary merger of two of your black holes compare to the ones we observe?
Good question, because I don't know what happens with foliation. I think that's an interesting question, because I want to have this foliation structure, but it looks, if I start, I know how this foliation structure embeds into a single black hole. In fact, Schwarzschild black hole. I don't know even if Kerr black holes exist. Yeah, I think there are no solutions, not because they're just difficult to find. Maybe they exist, but okay. Imagining that there are solutions for Kerr, then. If I start, rotating these two black holes around each other, something funny should happen with this foliation, it looks like, because it will be a kind of winding on its own. And I don't know if there can be strong effect. Maybe I should say, I didn't say something which I should start with. So for just, say, Schwarzschild solution that we have, in this theory, it resembles like the metric is almost the same as in general relativity. So there is like some small modification of the metric due to the presence of this additional scalar degree of freedom or this foliation, but that's small. So that's naturally small, smaller than one, say, much smaller than one. And the only like hope to get some big effect is to really to get some accumulation of the small effects due to non-trivial dynamics. But I don't know how to. I don't know how to simulate, you know, this this complicated dynamics.
The scalar degree of freedom that you have, would it? I don't know how you would it show up in other experiments? Usually, scalar tensor theories are extremely constrained.
Yes.
With massless scalars.
Well, this one would not produce a fifth force. Would not produce a like violation of weak equivalence principle. Well, instead, what it can produce is a breaking of Lorentz invariants in dark matter, ordinary matter, in the first place. And breaking of Lorentz invariants in ordinary matter is also very well constrained, of course. So somehow, one should ensure that this scalar field decouples from just ordinary fields, and that in principle possible due to randomization group running. So there are theories where randomization group running drives the coupling of this extra field to standard model to zero quite quickly.
Finally, yes. After all this work, can you shed any light on the cosmological constant problem?
No. I would love to.
the scalar still has couplings to the metric, so are you able to get modifications to, say, how fast you lose power in an in-spiral or something
yes.
like that?
Yes, yeah, that has...
That,
yeah.
that could be larger, because you spend a long time in that in-spiral. You can.
That has been, so. Right, that has been analyzed. There are studies, and they give constraints on the parameters of the theory. Well, essentially saying that, okay, so this effect should not be bigger than percent, and they constrain the certain parameters to be smaller than 10 to minus 2. Mm-hmm.
So in this parameter space, is there a point where scalar field is decoupled from tensor?
Well, here there is no tensor whatsoever because it's 2 plus 1 dimensional. So, but one can ask whether it decouples from the metric.
From matter.
Yeah, that one can ask. Introducing, adding here matter and see if scalar mode can decouple. In particular, I mean, this is very preliminary. That's something we're studying at the moment. But it may be that when we go along the trajectory like that, so first lambda becomes close to 1, and only then the gravitational coupling starts growing. So what happens is that first the scalar degree of freedom decouples from matter. So, here, if we're somewhere at this point, so we're still perturbative in the gravitational coupling, but we are, I mean, this lambda parameter is close to 1, then its interaction with ordinary matter is suppressed. So it probably decouples. But that's something quite preliminary.
But electric and scalar fields always remains tonally coupled in this.
Well, here it's hard to say because we don't have like dynamical gravitons. In 3 plus 1, yeah, I don't know what will happen. It's actually, this can be studied, yeah, I don't know.
Is there a fixed point that represents just Ising critical point with topological gravity in this space?
Well, you mean which topological gravity? The usual? The usual 2 plus 1. No, I don't think that you can say that there is a point where you can, I mean, when you go to that, you really recover exactly the 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity. What can happen, there can be some non-trivial limit. For example, we consider, actually, the exercise I was describing to you is to consider scattering of matter particles and, consider the scattering amplitude and see what happens to it if I take the limit lambda going to 1. And, if lambda is not close to 1, then there is an exchange by the scalar field. But if I start to cranking this, you know, this alpha, then I see that the scalar field decouples and I recover the amplitude, which is the same as in normal 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity. But that's, you know, like, I mean, this is at fixed, say, at fixed momenta, at fixed external momenta. So the limit won't be uniform. If I now also change the external momenta, I can go back to the I would say I can again increase the contribution of the scalar. Yeah. So no, there is no uniform limit, but there may be some non-trivial limit. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned in the, I think maybe two slides from here about these CG minus C gamma constraint,
mm-hmm.
the electromagnetic and gravitational wave detection.
Mm-hmm.
Is there no way that in the IR the theory could somehow hide that Lorentz violation by some, like, is that, I mean, do we have anything more than to sort of hope that that might happen?
Well, the
some like restoration of that symmetry at large scales.
Yeah, the analogy is the reasons to at least envisage that this may happen, that come from studies of non-gravitational series. Because there, the general property that when you consider a system with many degrees of freedom that are strongly interacting with each other, then they, at low energy, they tend to develop the same common velocity, which is quite natural. Yeah, and that, I mean, there are many examples where this happens. So here, the idea that maybe when there is gravitons, where the gravitons and say other matter fields, if they are all strongly coupled, they will actually acquire the same velocity in the infrared. But
strongly coupled seems to preclude describing something like us, right? So seeing as we
I think the idea that they will go through strong coupling phase,
right.
And then emerge at low energies. It's like QCD emerging as theory of pions at low energies.
Right. So there's some weakly coupled IR dual theory.
Yes.
What theoretical means would you use to try and understand this? I mean, something like Carroll QCD, you have symmetry breaking, you know, seeing things like Sedbrook duality, you have a lot of more symmetries to guide you. And is there any kind of toolbox available for what you're describing here, which is sort of almost like a gravitational dual theory, about a strongly coupled gravitational dual theory without string theory? Is there any toolbox that might be helpful?
We should discuss it with you. I have been scratching my head trying to invent something.
Okay. Okay. No, again, I'm confused. So in your approach, time and space are treated very differently.
Yes.
So how, I want to understand how it is that you have black hole analog solutions. Normally, if you go inside the black hole, time and space switch roles.
Well, I can draw something, if I may. So I can draw the Penrose diagram for these black holes. Okay, first this is Penrose diagram for normal black hole. Here there is horizon. And on this Penrose diagram, I will overlay the foliation. And the foliation goes like that. So okay, first normally it's normal. And this foliation sets the preferred time, right? So it goes like this, but then there is another surface here, somewhere inside, space-like surface, where the leaves of this foliation accumulate. Start behaving like that. So when you come, so here, say time, asymptotic time goes from minus infinity to infinity. But then when you come inside, you notice that this surface, this leaf of infinite time, it actually does not penetrate inside black hole, inside certain region. There is some region here which is shielded. Other way around. No signal from inside here can go out because the signals, of course, they can propagate as fast as you wish, but they can never go back in time. So they can propagate only along the leaves of the foliation. And all the leaves of the foliation that are here inside, they end up on the singularity or somewhere inside. So they don't go to the asymptotic infinity. So that's how the black hole looks like in this game.
So is there a match between these results and the ones obtained by asymptotic safety? Because if these fixed points existed, you would be able to see them also in the diagrams obtained by asymptotic safety.
Well, I think in asymptotic safety, the main challenge is to understand how we really describe this asymptotic fixed point, if any. And what is done is just to throw more and more operators. I mean, kind of, I mean, this bottom-up approach. But that's, I don't see how this procedure can converge. So because we know that, like, again, using analog of QCD and chiral field theory, we know that in chiral field theory, just we would have to throw, you know, infinite number of operators and still we would not probably be able to reproduce the ultraviolet behavior. So in this sense, I mean, just looking from bottom to top, yes, I mean, bottom up, I really don't see how this can work. On the other hand, this gives some idea, at least how to, you know, how to parameterize possible possible fixed points, strongly coupled fixed points of gravity. And because at this moment we don't know even how to characterize it. Unlike the case of conformal field theories in global spacetime, where we know that there should be algebra of operators obeying certain properties. So here we don't have any local operators. We don't know even what to say. So the connection to this asymptotic safety idea may be that using these tools we can devise, you know, some framework to parameterize strongly coupled gravitational theories, and then maybe try to work something top down, yeah, to kind of guess or postulate ultraviolet theory fixed point, and then see what would be the consequence at low energies.
Okay. So let's thank Sergei again.